can open it as a book. Well, this is the story, and maybe there's an alternative version somewhere.
Yeah.
And then I can compare them. But if it's an oral story that is handed down again and again, verbatim, the verbatimness becomes much more essential, I think, than for a story that is written down. And if you come from with a frame of mind, or stories are written down and something in books, and I can read it and can tell it to somebody else, you don't see how important it is that everything is really given verbatim, because it only happens at that moment when the story is told. And if you change something, you've changed it altogether. If there's an error in something written, you can always sort of do a collage and look at another version of that story and say, okay, there is something wrong here, and you can trace it back. But if it's oral, you can't. And if you take something out of that, I guess, oral tradition, write it down and it's a mistake in it, that mistake stays.
Yeah.
And this is just sort of part of the technical side. I think the underlying question we talked about that earlier, I think, is the sort of colonial appropriation and the displacement of origin, displacement of another culture via appropriation.
Yeah, and finally, I mean, after all the arguments about the philosophy and the aesthetics that well up in the appropriation, we just keep seeing people making money off our stuff. I mean, it seems like that's the only reason they're suddenly interested in our stuff, because it's like we've been, you know, working hard to get attention, and now that we're getting attention, they just want a share of our work.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. It's true. So how do you feel about this project?
I think it's useful. I think this has been, certainly for me, an opportunity to articulate some things that, I mean, normally I just sort of go my way doing my work and don't...
No, I mean this project.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's an opportunity for me to hear what I think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of those people who sort of doesn't know what I think until someone asks me, so...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, yeah. I think a lot of people feel that. I mean, about themselves.
Yeah.
There's something to realize, hey, that's what I think. If you think of writers, are there certain writers, native or non-native or so, that you would think have influenced you in your writing? In your thinking?
Well, certainly Lenore Kisha Tobias has.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for this last decade, we have shared our thoughts and our work.
Mm-hmm.
And our, you know, concerns. I guess beyond her, I feel like I just sort of have hooked onto anyone whose writing has been sufficiently oral to excite me or intrigue me.
So that would be, if you mentioned Gulliver's Travels earlier, could you mention some other sort of texts that you think intrigued you for a long time,
that you
think about, that you rewrite, that...
I go back to the plays of Joe Orton. I go back to the plays of Chekhov.
Mm-hmm.
I go back to the darker plays of Shakespeare, the tragedies. I discovered Sylvia Plath long before she got wild here. Emily Dickinson,
mm-hmm.
Gerard Manley Hopkins,
mm-hmm.
E.E. Cummings. I mean, I'm really in love with the pleasure of language, so it's like those people who do interesting things with the language,
yeah.
who make things out of it. I've made two words so far.
Yeah?
And I've stuck them in poems, and they've gotten by. And
which words?
Shrinkling.
Uh-huh.
And what was the other one? Oh, it was sort of a back formation, I think they call it, conflagrate as a verb.
Conflagrate.
Because it's like conflagration in English is a noun, but I couldn't find a verb, but I needed it. And
you know, English is limited in that way. It's very difficult to create new words. It's easier in some other languages. In German, for example, you can all the time create new nouns by just hooking several together until you got the exact meaning. And usually you can turn that into a verb too, although it's not done all the time. But I think that's very difficult in English. Right? And I can see why you're happy about having done those, because that's a difficult achievement, shrink thing. If you had to teach a course on native literature in Canada, which texts would you include, do you think?
Half-breed. I think the Rez Sisters. It's the better of the plays so far. I don't feel like I can adequately do that. I just feel like I'm naming my friends.
Okay, you might get into dire straits in conflict with other contributors here. Why did he leave out me? Okay, maybe I shouldn't ask that. Yeah. Do you find there is a good anthology of poetry, Canadian native writers? Actually, I can answer that myself. I don't think there's a representative one yet.
I don't think so.
Not yet. There are various sort of regional and sort of collections, but not. The same with short. Well, All My Relations is getting there, I guess. With short stories.
Yeah. But it's just such a big job, and it's just. I mean, a lot of the people who are doing the writing aren't doing it professionally yet.
No.
So it really is. It's just difficult to get that work. But it is coming. People are beginning to see that it is important work. That it's not something that they do in their spare time, but it is something that can be. I say this so often that it's begun to feel like a cliche, but it's an honorable way to live your life.
An honorable way to
live your life.
Oh yeah.
And I guess we're not allowed enough honor in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you would like to add from your side, or that you? A statement you would like to make, A, to be included in that book, and B, perhaps also where you address people across the Atlantic? That's really two questions.
I guess I hesitate to sound millennial, but I really do feel like some of the things that I'm saying, some of the things other Native people are saying, are essential things for our life here.
That's true.
As a planet.
Yeah.
And I hope people can hear them.
I think that a lot of the interest in Native writing and Native cultures comes from the realization, maybe more so in Europe, I hope so, than here, that we've come to the end on this road. because it's been straight going in one direction. I was talking to Howard for hours last night about to lots of people, and also people like Howard who come from a very strong Marxist tradition. I initially come from that too. That kind of connection, that kind of thought is not getting us anywhere anymore. There are other issues that are much larger. We've got to rethink, transcend categories, and think holistically is, I don't know whether that's a good word, but in wholeness and in circles, and not the linear road, because that's leading towards death. And a lot of people in the world realize that, and they know that. But Native people, not only in the Americas, but a lot of other fourth world people, have to say, is essential. And even in our own traditions, which we've displaced through Christianity, there's a lot that we've learned to despise as heathenish, which is very, very important. And people are very few, but people are starting to do something about it. Whether it's fast enough, I don't know. But I think a lot of people are aware and grateful for the help that Native people are giving us. And this is not only in literature, but also in... There were delegations supporting the peace movement in Germany when some more nuclear warheads were stationed by NATO and our whole country stockpiled with all that junk. Who was there to help out? It was Native people from all over the world. And a lot of people appreciate that. I don't know what your experience was in Belgium, whether you met with any of those people. I guess probably not. But it is there. It is there. It's not the powerful people. It's not the politicians. It's not the rich people. It's getting more. I'm not saying I'm optimistic about it. I think I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, it seems like a strange experience, because I mean I've went to the writing classes that we have here, and I sort of absorbed this image of the writer as someone who sort of goes off and does their art, and they're very separate. And as I live my life doing my art, I feel like I'm not separate. I've been thrown into history, and it's like when people ask me, where do you get your ideas? It's like they're coming at me all the time. It's coming, you know. It's just a matter of choosing the ones I think I can do justice to.
I've been tolerating this out. Okay. If you want to, I'll tell you a story.
Okay.
You don't have to listen. But I usually do that at the end, so we'll cut that out because I've told it other times too. But that's from the region that I come from. I come from a town called Rendsburg, which is on an island, a river island it used to. Now it's, the river is killed. There's the dam, and the island doesn't exist as that anymore. It's the Eider River. It's the old border river between Scandinavian tribes and Germanic tribes, and around there, Christianity sort of reached that region starting 860 or something, and it was spread by the sword, political measures, people sort of co-opting the sons of chiefs, taking them down to Aachen, to the court of Charlemagne and his successors, and there they would be Christianized and then go back to their people and spread Christianity on a very superficial level, fortunately, I say now. It was mainly a political thing. Anyway, so this story, I guess, is from that time. It's further down the river, towards the river flows first up north, very close to the Baltic. I live on a peninsula. And then it turns west to the North Sea. And first it's kind of hilly country, and then it gets really flat like a table, marshland. And it's where the island is, on the middle of this peninsula, where it's, we call it the sand back, but it's like a stretch of low hills, right in the middle, very poor country, very sandy and dry. And the little down the river from there was a ferryman. Home is still a village there. And he was in his hut or cabin, and he was sleeping. It was at night, and he woke up. He heard this funny noise on his window pane. I guess his window pane was scraped pigskin or something. And the cabin would be made of wattles and thatch. The houses still are thatch, the old houses anyway. But he heard this sound, and he didn't understand what was going on. Didn't see anything, didn't hear anything else, so he went back to sleep. So there was this little sound again, as if somebody was throwing sand against the pane. So he got up and opened the door, looked out. There was nobody. And he looked down and he saw all the way to the south, he saw light across the ground. All the way, like a big snake extending to the horizon, just like a snake of light. And then he bent down, he looked a little closer, and sure enough, he was sort of flickering that light. Sure enough, he bent down, and he was kind of sleepy, so he didn't see it. Those were tiny little lanterns and torches that the little people held. So there was a whole exodus of little people. They had everything. There were the old ones, the little ones. They had oxen and pigs and horses and carts and all the household goods, everything packed up. And they were on the move, obviously, and there were thousands of them. And so he bent down, and because they've got little voices on them, he said, "What do you want me to do?" He said, "Take us over." He said, "I can't take you all over. There's so many." He said, "You can do it. Try it." So he got his boat, and he said, "How are you going to pay me?" Because that's what his life depended on. He said, "We'll pay you all right. Don't worry. Just put down your cap." So he put down his cap. And they got in the boat with horses, wagons, everything, and the boat was sort of filled to the brim. It was so full of life and people and all this light, and he took them over. They got off the boat, and then he went back and got the next boat. And all the night he went back and forth, back and forth. And it was getting towards dawn, and in the east there was sort of faint light already when he got the next, the last load across. And when he sort of got back on the south side again where his hut was, he saw this big snake sort of moving out to the north. And then he saw some light glimmering by his door. That was where his cap was, and they put all the dust, gold dust or whatever in there. They never came by. That's the story. I think it's a sad story. Sometimes I cry when I tell it because the people, little people left. But you know, it's like a coyote story. They didn't all leave. There's still lots of other stories where individual sort of little people live by farms and so on. Anyway, that's my story. I don't know very many stories, but there's some that I miss. And the kids like it, especially if you are in the location where it happened. I remember when our kids had birthday, and right next to where we live, we don't live in that region anymore, but still in the north of Germany, and there's something called the Icker Loch. Icker is the name of the village, and Loch means hole. And this is a caved in earth formation. It's a pool, but it's bottomless. It goes all the way down, and it's connected with an underwater river system or something. And there's some stories connected to that, whereas historically it only opened up in 1830 or something. There are records of that. But there are already all kinds of stories telling who lived there. So. And who knows? And the kids love it. And we have holiday. Is that where this mermaid lived?
Yeah.
That's the farm up there where they took her little daughter. Do they still have it? No.
Spirits of place. Spirits of place.
Yeah. Anything else you want to add? Well, thank you. The mic there.
Okay.
Well, I think I'd like to, we talked about this earlier, and I'd like to start by asking you how you got started writing. What made you write? What makes you write?
I guess pleasure is the simplest answer. I know that at a certain point in high school, I had decided that I needed to be an artist, that I was concerned with all those things that were talked about when I went to church, but that the church wasn't doing it.
Which church was that?
It was it's an Anglican mission on our reserve. I think that I was being very practical, having listened to people saying that an artist lives a difficult and impoverished life, and I was just thinking, well, pencil and paper aren't expensive. But I think by that point I had already had a number of experiences just in doing work for a school where in the composition of a piece, I had entered that state of mind where you're totally involved in what you're doing, and there's just a real excitement that, you know, a story is coming out.